all their preceding life had prepared them only for an artificially conditioned environment. Their struggle out in freedom had consisted in adopting and transmitting resolutions and instructions already approved by their higher-ups, with the help of the telephone and the electric bell. In camp conditions where the struggle most frequently was hand-to-hand, with unarmed prisoners marching against machine pistols, crawling on their bellies under fire, they were the Sidor Polikarpoviches, or the Dil Tomatoviches, frightening no one and good for nothing. And even less did these principled warriors for universal human happiness offer any hindrance to the depredations of the thieves, nor did they object to the dominance of the thieves in the kitchens and among the trustees. Just read General Gorbatov. You can find it there. For it was on the basis of their theory that the socially friendly thieves got such vast power in camp. They didn't prevent the thieves from plundering weak zeks in their presence, and they themselves did not resist being plundered by them. And all this was completely logical. There were no loose ends lying about, and no one disputed it. But then the time came to write our history, and the first half-stifled voices were raised about life in the camps. And the good thinkers looked back and were pained. How could that be? They who were so progressive, so conscientious, and they had not struggled. And they had not even known that there was a personality cult of Stalin. In 1957, the head of the personnel department of the Ryazan Province Education Department asked me, "What were you arrested for in 1945? "For speaking out against the cult of personality," I replied. "How can that be?" She was astonished. "Was there a cult of personality then?" She was seriously under the impression that the cult of personality had been proclaimed only in 1956. So how could it have been there in 1945? And they certainly hadn't supposed that dear Lavrenty Pavlovich Beria was an inveterate enemy of the people. And they had to hasten to spread some kind of muddied version to the effect that they had struggled. And all the snarling dogs on magazines who felt up to it blamed my Ivan Denisovich, the son of a bitch, for not waging a struggle. Moskovskaya Pravda, December 8, 1962, even reproached Ivan Denisovich for not going to the underground meetings arranged by the communists in camp, claiming he was unwilling to learn from thinking people. But what kind of delirium is this? What underground meetings? And why? To show the finger inside their pockets? And at whom would they have shown that finger, if from the junior jailer right on up to Stalin himself, one and all were that same Soviet power? So when and with what methods did they struggle? No one can tell you that. And what were they thinking about then, if all they allowed themselves to do was keep repeating that everything that is real is rational? What were they thinking of if their entire prayer was, "Do not beat me, please, O whip of the Tsar"? B. Relationship to the camp administration. What kind of attitude, other than the most respectful and friendly, could the good thinkers have toward the camp chiefs? After all, the camp chiefs were all party members and were carrying out the party's directives, and it was not their fault that I equals the one and only innocent, had been sentenced and sent here. The orthodox communists understood quite well that if they themselves had suddenly turned up in the position of the camp chief, they would have done everything just as he did. Todorsky, whom today our whole press has proclaimed a camp hero — he is a former seminarist who became a journalist, singled out by Lenin, and by the 30s for some reason installed as the chief of the Air Force Academy, though he was not a flyer — would even, according to Dyakov's account, talk to the supply chief, whom a slogger would pass without a glance, like this: "How can I serve you, citizen chief?" For the chief of the medical section, Todorsky composed a synopsis of this short course of party history. If Todorsky ever had any thoughts in the least unlike those in the short course, then where were his principles? How could he compose a synopsis exactly according to Stalin? They will object, principles are principles, but sometimes it is necessary to be elastic. There was a period when Ulbricht and Dimitrov instructed their communist parties to make peace with the Nazis and even support them. Well, we have nothing to top that. That's dialectics. And if he really thought precisely like that, then that's what is called perished comically. But it is too little to love one's camp bosses. What is required is that the bosses love you. It is necessary to explain to the chiefs that we are of the same stuff as you, and you have to take care of us somehow. And this is why the heroes of Serebryakova, Shelest, Dyakov, Alden Semyonov, on every occasion, whether necessary or not, whether convenient or not, when the prisoner transport is being received, when the names are read out from the lists, declare themselves communists. That is their application for a cozy spot. Shelest even thinks up a scene like this. At the Kotlas Transit Prison, the roll is being called. Party member, asks the chief. What fools is he writing this for? Where in a prison list is there a column for party membership? Member of the Communist Party of Bolsheviks, replies Shelest to the faked question. And one has to give the chiefs their due, Dzerzhinsky men or Beria men. They heard, and they arranged things for them. Yes, and were there not perhaps some written, or at least oral, directives to make things easier for the communists? For even in periods of the sharpest persecutions of the 58s, when they were being ousted from all jobs as trustees, former big-shot communists for some reason kept their places. For example, in Kraslag, former member of the military council of the North Caucasus military district, Aralov, remained as brigadier of the vegetable gardeners, and former general Ivanchik remained as a brigadier for cottages, and former secretary of the Moscow committee, Dedkov, also kept a soft spot. But even without any directive, plain solidarity and plain self-interest, you today, me tomorrow, were bound to compel the MVD men to look after the true believers. And the way it turned out was that the chiefs kept the orthodox communists at their right hand, so that they constituted a firmly established privileged stratum in camp. But this did not extend to the quiet, rank-and-file communists, who did not go to the chiefs to trumpet their faith. Alden Semyonov writes quite straightforwardly that the communist camp chiefs tried to transfer communist prisoners to lighter work, and Dyakov doesn't conceal it either. The newcomer Rom announced to the chief of the hospital that he was an old Bolshevik, and right away he was assigned as a medical section clerk, an enviable post. And the camp chief also gave orders that Todorsky was not to be removed from his post as a medical orderly. But the most remarkable case of all is recounted by G. Shelest in his Kolyma Notes. A new MVD bigshot arrived there and recognized the prisoner Zaborsky as his former corps commander from the Civil War. They wept on meeting. Go ahead, ask half my kingdom. And Zaborsky agreed to accept special food from the kitchen and to take as much bread as he needed. In other words, to eat the bread of the sloggers, since no one was going to prescribe a new ration norm for him. And asked only to be given a 6-volume set of Lenin to read in the evening by the light of the kerosene lamp. And that is how everything was arranged. During the day he was fed with stolen rations. In the evening he read Lenin. And that is how, openly and with enjoyment, vileness is glorified. Shelest writes about some kind of mythical underground Politburo of the work brigade. A bit too big a deal, wasn't it, for a work brigade? Which managed to get hold of a loaf of bread from the bread-cutting room after hours, as well as a bowl of oatmeal. And what that means is that we have our own trustees everywhere. And also, let's swipe what we can, good thinkers. That very same Shelest gives us his final conclusion. Some survived thanks to their strength of spirit. Those were those orthodox communists swiping bread and cereal. While others survived thanks to an extra bowl of oatmeal. That was Ivan Denisovich. Well, so be it. Ivan Denisovich had no friends among the trustees. Just tell us one thing. Who laid the bricks? Who laid the bricks in the wall? Was it you, you hard heads? C. Attitude toward labor. It appears that on the whole, the Orthodox communists were devoted to work. Ike's deputy, even in a typhoid delirium, could calm down only when the nurse assured him that, yes, the telegrams on grain procurements had already been sent. It appears that on the whole, they approved of camp labor also. It was necessary to the building of communism, and without it the issuing of gruel to the whole horde of prisoners would have been undeserved. Therefore they considered it quite rational that persons refusing to go out to work should be beaten and imprisoned in the punishment block and shot in wartime. They considered it quite moral to be a worker signer, a brigadier, any kind of cattle driver or whipcracker. And in this regard they disagreed with the so-called honest thieves, and were in agreement with the bitches. Take, for example, the brigadier of the logging brigade, Yelena Nikitina, a former secretary of the Kiev Komsomol Committee. Here is what they say about her. She stole from the output of her own brigade, of 58s, and traded it with the thieves. Lyusha Zhaparidze, daughter of a Baku commissar, bought her way out of the work from Nikitina, with chocolate received in a food parcel. On the other hand, this woman brigadier refused to let the anarchist Tatiana Garasieva leave the woods for 3 days, until she had frostbite. Take Prokhorov Pustover, also a Bolshevik, though not a party member, who turned in Zeks for deliberately failing to fulfill norms. He used to report this to the chiefs, and the Zeks got punished. To the Zek's reproaches that he must realize it was slave labor, Pustover replied, "That's a strange philosophy. In capitalist countries, the workers struggle against slave labor, but we, even if we are slaves, work for a socialist state, not for private persons. These officials are only temporarily in power. One blow from the people, and they will disappear, but the people's state will remain." It's a jungle, the consciousness of an Orthodox communist. It's impossible to make sense of it. And the only exception the good thinkers make is this reservation for themselves. It would be wrong to use them on general camp work, since it would then be difficult for them to preserve themselves for the future fertile leadership of the Soviet people. And anyway, it would also be difficult for them to think during those years in camp. In other words, to repeat in turn, one after another while gathered in a circle, that Comrade Stalin, Comrade Molotov, Comrade Beria, and all the rest of the party were right. And therefore, using all their efforts under the protection of the camp chiefs and with each other's secret help, they tried to get themselves places as trustees in jobs where no knowledge or skills were required. None of them was a specialist. In calm and quiet places, farther from the main hand-to-hand camp struggle. And so they grabbed hold. Zakharov, Malenkov's teacher, as storage room clerk for personal property. The above-mentioned Zaborsky, Shelest himself, at the clothing issue desk. The notorious Todorsky, in the medical section. Konokotin, as a medical assistant, though he was not a medical assistant at all. Serebryakova as a nurse, though she was no nurse at all. And Aldan Semyonov was also a trustee. The camp biography of Dyakov, the biggest loudmouth of all the loyalists, has been depicted by his own pen and is truly astonishing. During the 5 years of his sentence he contrived to leave the camp compound just once, and then for only half a day, and during that half day he worked for half an hour cutting branches. And then the jailer said to him, "You're fagged out. Take a rest." Half an hour in 5 years. Not everyone gets away with that. For a certain length of time, he malingered on the pretext of a rupture, and subsequently a fistula resulting from the rupture. But listen here, not for 5 years. To receive such golden jobs as medical statistician, librarian of the cultural and educational section, and storage room clerk for personal possessions, and to stay in such jobs for your entire term. A bribe of fat bacon wasn't enough. Most likely you had to sell your soul to the godfather as well. Let the old camp veterans be the judge of this. And Dyakov was not merely a trustee, but an aggressive trustee. In the first version of his story, before he was publicly shamed for it, He elegantly explained why an intelligent person ought to avoid the crude lot of the people. A chess tactic, castling, that is, setting someone else in the forefront of the battle. And this is the person who has now taken it upon himself to become the principal interpreter of camp life. G. Serebryakova reports to us on her own camp biography with careful omissions. There are said to be serious witnesses against her. I did not have the opportunity of checking this. Not only the authors themselves, but all the rest of the loyalists are also portrayed by this chorus of authors as being outside manual labor, either in the hospital or in trusty jobs where they carry on their obscurantist, although somewhat updated, conversations. These writers are not telling lies. They simply didn't have enough imagination to show those hard heads engaged in labor useful to society. How can you portray it if you never worked yourself? D. Attitude toward escapes. The hardheads themselves never attempt to escape. You see, that would have been an act of struggle against the regime, a dislocation of the MVD. In other words, an act of subversion of Soviet power. Furthermore, every orthodox communist always had two or three petitions for pardon traveling around in the highest appeals jurisdictions. And an escape might be interpreted there, at the top, as lack of patience, even as lack of confidence, in the highest jurisdictions. Anyway, the good thinkers didn't need freedom in general. They didn't need the ordinary common freedom of humans and birds. Every truth is concrete. And the only freedom they needed was freedom given them by the state, lawful freedom, duly signed and sealed, with a return to their pre-arrest situation and privileges. Without that, what use was freedom? Well, and if they themselves didn't try to escape, then all the more did they condemn the escapes of others as pure subversion of the MVD system and of economic construction. And if escapes were so detrimental, then it was probably the civic duty of a loyal communist, on learning of an escape attempt, to denounce it to the comrade security chief. Was it not logical? True, there were one-time members of the underground among them, and bold people from the Civil War. But their dogma had transformed them into political riffraff. E. Attitude toward the rest of the 58s. They never mingled with their comrades in distress. This would have been non-party conduct, sometimes in secret among themselves, and sometimes quite openly too, for there was no risk in it for them. They opposed themselves to the dirty 58s, and attempted to regain purity by holding themselves apart. It was precisely this simple-hearted mass that they had led out in freedom, where they never allowed it to utter a free word. And now, when they turned out to be in the same cells with them, on equal terms, they still weren't in the least depressed by it, and shouted as much as they pleased, "That's what you deserve, scoundrels! You were all pretending out there in freedom. You are all enemies, and they were right to arrest you. Everything is in order, and everything is progressing toward the great victory. I am the only one unjustly imprisoned." And the loyalists seriously ascribed to the strength of the all-conquering teaching the absence of any resistance to the path of their prison monologues, because the administration was always on the side of the orthodox communists, and the KRs did not even dare raise an objection, since otherwise they would get second terms. To the strength of the all-conquering doctrine. Well, it could happen now and then that there was a different relationship of forces. A certain prosecutor imprisoned in Unschlag had to pretend to be an idiot, and for more than a year, too. That was his only means of saving himself from reprisals. He was imprisoned along with his godchildren. It was with frank contempt, with commanding class hatred, that the orthodox communists gazed around them at all the 58s except themselves. Dyakov, "I thought with horror, who are we among here?" Konokotin didn't want to give an injection to a sick Vlasov man, though as a medical assistant it was his duty. But he self-sacrificingly contributed blood for a sick convoy guard. Just like their free doctor, Balinov, "First of all, I am a Czechist, and then I am a physician." Now that is medicine. "Now we understand why honest people are required in the hospital," Dyakov, "so as to know who to inject and who not." And they transformed this hatred into action. How could they and why should they keep this class hatred to themselves? In Schelest's account, Samuel Gendow, a professor, probably of communist jurisprudence, provided the ammunition when the lack of any desire to go out to work on the part of the Caucasian nationalities became apparent. The Muslim mullah must be suspected of sabotage. F. Attitude toward stool pigeons. Just as all roads lead to Rome, so all the preceding points lead us to this one. It was impossible for the hardheads not to cooperate with the best and most sincere of the camp chiefs, the security chief. In their situation, this was the most reliable method of helping the NKVD, the state, and the party. In addition, it was very profitable. It was the best way of getting together with the higher-ups. Services rendered to the Godfather did not go unrewarded. The only means of sticking for years on end in the best trusty soft spots inside the camp compound was with the help of the Godfather. In one of the books about camp from the same orthodox communist wave, here is the camp system of values of the positive communist Kratov, who is the author's favorite. 1. Survive at any price, adapting to everything. 2. It is better for decent people to become stool pigeons, because it's better than to leave it to scoundrels. But even if some orthodox communist got stubborn and chose not to work for the Godfather, it was still hard for him to avoid that door. The security chief would certainly not omit to offer an affectionate invitation to all true believers, who loudly proclaimed their faith, asking in a fatherly tone, "Are you a Soviet person?" And the loyalist could not answer no, and that meant yes. And if the answer was yes, then come and collaborate, comrade. There is nothing to hinder you. Ivanov Razumnik recalls that they managed to expose 3 stoolies in their Butyrki cell, and all 3 turned out to be communists. Only now, when distorting the entire history of the camps, are they ashamed to admit their collaboration. Not all of them got caught red-handed, like Liza Kotik, who dropped a written denunciation. But now someone has blurted out that security officer Sokofikov used to send off Dyakov's letters for him, bypassing the camp censor. And the only thing unsaid is, in exchange for what did he send them? That kind of friendship, whence came it? They remember to report that the security officer Yakovlev advised Todorsky not to declare himself a communist openly, but they don't go on to explain why he was concerned about this. But this is only temporary. Already at hand is that glorious time when people will be able to fling restraint to the winds and admit loudly, "Yes, we were stoolies, and we are proud of it." I wrote this at the beginning of 1966, and at the end of that same year I read Bukovsky's essay in Oktyabr, magazine number 9. Just as I predicted, they are already bragging openly. However, why this whole chapter? Why this whole lengthy survey and analysis of the loyalists? Instead, we shall just write in letters a yard high. Janos Kadar and Vladislav Gomulka. And now we can add also Gustav Husak. They both underwent unjust arrest and interrogation with torture, and both of them served time so and so many years. And the whole world sees how much they learned. The whole world has learned what they are worth. Chapter 12. Knock, knock, knock. The Cheka GB, no doubt a resonant, convenient, and concise name for this organization, and one which also preserves its continuity in time, would be an insensate log incapable of carrying out surveillance over its people if it did not have a constant eye and a constant ear. In our technological years, cameras and photoelectric elements often work in place of eyes, and microphones, tape recorders, and laser listening devices often replace ears. But for the entire epoch covered by this book, almost the only eyes and almost the only ears of the Cheka GB were stool pigeons. In the early years of the Cheka, they were called, in a businesslike manner, secret collaborators, in contrast to staff employees who were in the open. In the manner of those years, this was abbreviated to the term seksuti, and that is how it passed into general usage. Whoever thought up this word, not supposing it would become so widely disseminated, and not taking due care, did not have the gift of perceiving it with unprejudiced ear and hearing even in its mere sound the loathsomeness woven into it, something more disreputable even than sodomy. And over the years it became coloured with the yellowish-brown blood of betrayal, and there was no nastier word in the whole Russian language. But this word was used only in freedom. In the archipelago they had their own words. In prison it was a nasedka, a sitting hen. And in camp it was a stukach, a knocker, stool pigeons, all. However, just as many words of the archipelago subsequently moved out into the whole range of the Russian language and took over the entire country, so too the word knocker became in time a common concept. This reflected both the unity and the universality of the phenomenon itself. Without having the experience and without having thought the matter over sufficiently, it is difficult to evaluate the extent to which we are permeated and enveloped by stool pigeoning, just as, without a transistor in hand, we do not sense in a field, in a forest, or on a lake, that multitudes of radio waves are constantly pouring through us. It is difficult to school oneself to ask that constant question, who is the stool pigeon among us? In our apartment, in our courtyard, in our watch repair shop, in our school, in our editorial office, in our workshop, in our design bureau, and even in our police. It is difficult to school oneself, and it is repulsive to become schooled, but for safety one must. It is impossible to expel the stoolies or to fire them. They will recruit new ones. But you have to know them, sometimes in order to beware of them, sometimes to put on an act in their presence, to pretend to be something you aren't. Sometimes in order to quarrel openly with the informer and by this means devalue his testimony against you. We will speak in a special chapter on freedom about the density of the network of informers. Many sense this destiny, but they do not make the effort to imagine the informer's face, his simple human face, and for this reason the network seems more enigmatic and more fearsome than in actual fact it is. And yet the informer is that very same pleasant Anna Fyodorovna, who lives next door and came in to ask you for some yeast, and then ran to report at a prearranged contact point, perhaps a shop or a drugstore, that an unregistered visitor is in your apartment. It is that very same Ivan Nikiforovich, whom you like so much, with whom you drank a glass of vodka, and he reported that you cursed because there was nothing in the store to buy, and said the higher-ups were getting it all under the counter. You don't know informers face to face, and then you are surprised that the omnipresent organs could know that during the mass singing of the Song on Stalin, you merely opened your mouth and didn't waste your voice. Or that you didn't enjoy yourself at the November the 7th demonstration. Well, where were they, those penetrating and burning informers' eyes? But the informer's eyes can be a languid blue or hold a senile tear. It is not at all necessary for them to gleam wickedly. Do not expect that he will always be a villain who looks repulsive. He is an ordinary human being like you and me, with a measure of good feelings, a measure of malice and envy, and with all the weaknesses which make us vulnerable to spiders. If the recruitment of stool pigeons were entirely voluntary and based on enthusiasm, there would be few of them, as it was perhaps in the '20s. But the recruitment proceeds by means of entanglement and capture, and his weaknesses are what betray a person into this shameful service. And even those who honestly want to rid themselves of this sticky spider web, this second skin, just can't. Recruitment is in the very air of our country, in the fact that what belongs to the state is higher than what belongs to the individual, that Pavlik Morozov is a hero, that a denunciation is not a denunciation, but a help to the person denounced. Recruitment is interlaced with ideology, for if the organs wish it, then the recruited person must also wish for one and the same thing, our country's successful advance to socialism. The technical side of recruitment is beyond praise. Alas, our detective comics do not describe these methods. The recruiters work at propaganda centres before elections. The recruiters work on the faculties of Marxism-Leninism. They call you in. There's some kind of commission there. Go on in. The recruiters work in army units barely back from the front lines. A smersh man comes and jerks in half your company one at a time. With some he merely talks about the grits and the weather. With some he assigns to keep watch on each other and on their commanders. A craftsman is sitting in his den, repairing leather goods. A friendly man enters. "Could you fix this buckle for me?" And quietly he adds, "You are to shut down your shop right now and go out on the street. There is an automobile there with license number 37-48. Open the door without hesitation and get in. It will take you where you are to go." And when you get there, the whole thing is routine. "Are you a Soviet person? In that case, you must help us." And a shop like that is a wonderful place for gathering denunciations from citizens. And for a personal meeting with the security chief, there is the Sidorov apartment, second floor, 3 rings, from 6 to 8 p.m. The poetry of recruitment of stool pigeons still awaits its artist. There is a visible life, and there is an invisible life. The spider webs are stretched everywhere, and as we move, we do not notice how they wind about us. Selecting tools available for recruitment is like selecting master keys. Number one, number two, number three. Number one, are you a Soviet person? Number two is to promise that which the person being recruited has fruitlessly sought by lawful means for many years. Number three is to bring pressure to bear on some weak point, to threaten a person with what he fears most of all. Number four, you see, it only takes a tiny bit of pressure. A certain A.G. is called in, and it is well known that he is a nincompoop. And so to start, he is instructed, "Write down a list of the people you know who have anti-Soviet attitudes." He is distressed and hesitates. "I'm not sure." He didn't jump up and didn't thump the table. How dare you? Who does in our country? Why deal in fantasies? "Aha, so you are not sure. Then write a list of people you can guarantee are 100% Soviet people. But you are guaranteeing, you understand. If you provide even one of them with false references, you yourself will go to prison immediately. So why aren't you writing?" "Well, I can't guarantee." "Aha, you can't. That means you know they are anti-Soviet. So write down immediately the ones you know about." And so the good and honest rabbit, A.G., sweats and fidgets and worries. He has too soft a soul formed before the revolution. He has sincerely accepted this pressure which is bearing down on him. Write either that they are Soviet or that they are anti-Soviet. He sees no third way out. A stone is not a human being, and even stones get crushed. There are more master keys in freedom because life is more varied. In camp they are of the simplest sort. Life has been simplified, laid bare, and the threading of the screw and the diameter of its head are well known. Number one, of course, remains. Are you a Soviet person? It is very applicable to the loyalists, and the screwdriver will never slip, and the screw head starts immediately and keeps going. Number two also works very well indeed. A promise to have the prisoner taken off general work and to have trusty work arranged for him in the camp compound, and to see that he gets supplementary grits and some pay, and has his term reduced. That's all life, and every such little step preserves life. During the war years, stool pigeoning really got to be conspicuously small-time stuff. Objects got more expensive, and people got cheaper. Souls were sold for just a pack of tobacco. And number three works even better. We will take your trusty status away. We will send you out to general work. We will transfer you to a penalty camp. Every one of those steps was a step toward death, and the person who could not be coaxed upward by a piece of bread could still shudder and beg for mercy if he was pushed into the abyss. This does not mean that finer, more skillful work did not exist or was never needed. Great ingenuity was sometimes required. Major Shikin had to gather material against the prisoner Gertzenberg, a Jew. He had grounds for thinking that Anton, an inexperienced 17-year-old German lad, could provide the material he wanted. Shikin called in young Anton and began to water the Nazi shoots implanted there. How repulsive the Jewish nation was, and how it had destroyed Germany. Anton got steamed up and betrayed Gertzenberg. And why wouldn't the communist Czechist Shikin have become, under altered circumstances, a dependable interrogator for the Gestapo? Or take Alexander Filipovich Stepovoy. Before his arrest, he was a soldier in the MVD armies, and he had been arrested under Article 58. This is the only chance I will have to tell the story of his arrest. He was conscripted as a boy and sent off to serve in the MVD armies. First, into battle against the Ukrainian partisans, the Banderists. Having received information from informers as to when the Banderists were coming out of the forest to attend mass, the MVD surrounded the church and took them as they came out, on the basis of photographs. Later, they also guarded, in civilian clothing, people's deputies in Lithuania when the latter went to election meetings. One of them was very bold and always declined to have a guard with him. Later still, they guarded a bridge in Gorky province. They themselves mutinied over poor food and as punishment were sent to the Turkish border. But by this time, Stepovoy had already been imprisoned. He used to draw pictures as a hobby, even on the covers of notebooks in political indoctrination courses. On one occasion he drew a pig, and then someone next to him asked, "Can you draw Stalin?" "I can." And he drew a picture of Stalin on the spot. And he turned in his notebook to be checked by the instructor. That was already quite enough to warrant his arrest, but beyond that, at target practice in the presence of a general, he had scored 7 out of 7 bullseyes at a distance of 400 yards and got leave to go home. When he returned to his unit, he reported there were no fruit trees left. All the orchards had been cut down because of the tax on them imposed by Zverev. At his court-martial in Gorky province, he shouted, "Oh, you scoundrels! If I am an enemy of the people, why don't you try me in front of everyone? What are you hiding from?" Then Berlepolom and Krasnaya Glinka, a cruel, strict regiment camp consisting only of 58s, who worked on tunnelling. He was not an orthodox communist at all, just an ordinary lad from the working classes. And in camp he came to be ashamed of his former service and carefully concealed it, realizing that it would be dangerous for him if it became known. So how was he to be recruited as an informer? Well, he was to be recruited with just that. "We will let it be known that you are a Czechist." They would even wipe their asses with their own banner, anything in order to recruit. He insists that he nonetheless stood up against them. Someone else might, as the saying goes, be nothing at all, but merely want to be a stoolie. Someone like that could be had without any difficulty. For another, it might be necessary to cast the bait several times before he swallowed it. To anyone who wavered and squirmed on the grounds that it was difficult for him to gather exact information, they would explain, "Give us what you have and we will check it out." "But if I'm not at all sure?" "What does that mean? That you're a real enemy?" And in the end they would explain quite honestly, "What we need is 5% truth and the rest can be your imagination." The Jida security chiefs. But sometimes it did happen that the godfather would keep trying and trying without landing his prey either on his third try or on his fifth. The word kum in Dahl's dictionary is given as meaning one in a state of spiritual kinship, the godfather of one's child by christening. And so the transfer of this term to the camp security officer was very precise and quite in the spirit of the language, but with that touch of irony customary with the Czechs. This was rare, but it happened. Then the godfather had his spare noose left, a signature on non-disclosure. Nowhere, either in the Constitution or in the Code, did it ever say that such signatures exist or that we are obliged to give them, but we have got used to everything. How can we refuse this either? We certainly will give all of them. Yet, at the same time, if we didn't give them, if on crossing the threshold we were to announce to one and all our conversation with the Godfather, then indeed the demonic strength of the third section would be dispelled. It is on our cowardice that their secrecy and they themselves are founded. And then a liberating and happy notation is put into the prisoner's camp file, "Not to be recruited." That is after try 96, or at least 84, but it is a long time before we learn about it, if we survive at all. We can make a guess, however, from the fact that all that scum subsides from us and never clings to us again. However, most often of all, the recruitment succeeds. Crudely and simply, they put on more and more pressure, so much that you can neither beg nor growl your way out of it. and soon afterward the new recruit brings in a denunciation. And as often as not, the denunciation tightens the noose of a second term around someone's neck. And camp squealing turns out to be the strongest form of camp struggle. You quote today, me tomorrow. Out in freedom, stool pigeoning was a totally safe occupation for an entire half-century or 40 years. There was no answering threat from society, and neither exposure nor punishment could occur. In the camps it was somewhat different. The reader will recall how the stool pigeons were exposed and exiled to Kondrostrov by the administrative section of Solovki. But for decades after, things were seemingly free and easy for the stool pigeons. But at occasional rare intervals, and in occasional rare places, a small group of resolute and energetic Zeks would join forces and continue the Solovetsky tradition in hidden form. Sometimes they would beat up and kill a stool pigeon on the pretext of lynch law, a crowd stirred up against a thief caught stealing. In camp terms, lynch law was almost lawful. Sometimes, as in camp number one of Vyatlag during the war, the work trustees would expel the most malevolent of the stool pigeons from their own construction project for the sake of efficiency. It was hard for the security chief to help in that kind of case. Other stool pigeons caught on and clammed up. High hopes were placed in the front-line soldiers when they arrived. They would go after the stoolies. Alas, the military reinforcements were a disappointment to the camp warriors. Outside their army, these warriors, artillerymen and scouts, went totally sour and were good for nothing. But what was required was more tolling of the bell, more passage of time, before the extermination of stoolies would get underway in the archipelago. I do not have enough material for this chapter. For some reason, old camp hands are not very eager to tell me about how they were recruited. I will therefore speak about myself. Only with my later camp experience, as I became a veteran, did I look back and comprehend how pettily, how insignificantly, I had begun my term. Having become used in my officer's pelt to an undeservedly high position among those around me, in camp too I kept climbing into positions of some kind, and immediately falling out of them. And I clung tightly to that pelt, to my field shirt, breeches, greatcoat. How hard I tried not to exchange it for the dark camp camouflage. In new conditions I made the mistake of the new recruit. I drew attention to myself in a new locality. And the sniper's eye of the very first godfather at Novi Jerusalem noticed me right off. And at Kaluga Gates also, just as soon as I got out of the painter's brigade and became an assistant to the norm setter, I dragged out that uniform once again. Oh, how one wants to be masculine and handsome. Furthermore, I lived in that chamber of monstrosities where even the generals didn't doll up like that. I had forgotten to wonder about how and why I had written my autobiography in Novi Jerusalem. One evening, I was reading a physics text, half lying on my cot. Zinoviev was frying something and telling a story. Orachevsky and Prokhorov were lying there with their boots on the footrail of the cots. When in came the senior jailer, named Senin. Evidently this was not his real name, but a camp pseudonym. He seemed not to notice the hot plate or the boots sticking out there, and he sat down on someone's cot and joined in the general conversation. I didn't like either his face or his manner, that Senin. He used to flash his soft eyes too much, but he was, oh, so cultured, so well-mannered, so different from all the rest of our jailers, boors, incompetents, illiterates. Senin was no more and no less than a university student, a fourth-year student, but I simply don't remember in which faculty. This book is continued on cassette 3, side 1.